Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Umbrella Hour. This is Xander Keg. I am flying solo today as host. Dr. Ann Goldbauer will be back with us next episode. We have a really wonderful show for you today. I'm going to be interviewing three different gentlemen who are affiliated with the International Institute for Trauma and Addiction Professionals. First, we have Dr. David Fawcett. David is a social worker, a clinical sexologist. He's also a certified sex addiction therapist. He's the author of a book that talks about addictions and mental health. He's been working in that field for over three decades. Since 2000, he has specialized in treating fused drug use and sexual behavior. This is also known as chemsex or sexualized drug use. I hope we get into a little bit of that during our discussion. And he's become a leading authority on achieving both chemsex sobriety and also integrating healthy sex and intimacy into recovery. Next up, we have Dr. Robert Hudson. Robert is a United Kingdom Center for Psychotherapy registered psychotherapist. He specializes in sex addiction therapy and recovery. He's also a certified sex addiction therapist at the supervisory level. He's the founder of Relationship Therapy and Recovery, which is located in London. He respects his client's best interests when providing therapy and undertakes to respect his client's autonomy. Robert considers issues of diversity, sexuality, and equality, as all of these affect the aspects of his work. And then we have Randall McDaniel. Randall serves as the marketing and special project manager at the International Institute for Trauma and Addiction Professionals, also known as ITAP, which is how we'll refer to it going forward. He has been instrumental in the growth of the Rainbow Advocate Program since its inception in 2021. The program has expanded significantly under his guidance, and we're going to be learning more about the Rainbow Advocate Program and everything else about ITAP going forward. Welcome to all three of you. I'm really happy to have you here with us talking about ITAP today. We're going to start with Randall. Randall is going to talk to us a little bit about what ITAP is, what they do, just this general overview. And then we're going to hear from David, who's going to talk about the introductory track of the certification training program. And then we'll have Robert come in and talk to us specifically about the clinical track in the certification program at IIATP. But let's go ahead and start with you, Randall. Why don't you give us just a good overview and maybe also tell us a little bit about that Rainbow program?
Thank you, Xander. The Rainbow Advocate and Educator Program is a certification that ITAP has offered since 2021. ITAP is the parent company, and we've been in business for almost 30 years. Certifications for the certified sex addiction therapist, there's a certified partner trauma therapist certification, among others. Rainbow Advocate certification is, it's like an attestation to a special ability, and the training gives us this ability to provide affirming care, regardless of their field or industry, using proper language when interacting with the LGBTQ community. It's more than a sensitivity training because no one's being forced to take the training. It's not here to meet a requirement for employment, although it could stand that test. Our certified members are sensitive to this population. So in short, by participating and asking questions, the training will end up meeting you where you are with your comfort level with this population. We offer the space to learn and grow with this training.
That's wonderful. Thank you for describing that and explaining it. Next up, we have David. David is going to give us an explanation for the introductory track within the certification program.
Thanks. And that was a great introduction by Randall. And then we build on that first level, which is a three-day intensive training program. It's team taught. There are two of us. It's really an introductory level. And as Randall said, everybody comes in at their different level. A lot of people think they come in knowing pretty much what there is to know. And I think when we start drilling down, people are amazed at the level of things they might not have understood or the cultural context they were unaware of, terminology, what clients are looking for to feel safe and emotionally able to open up in someone's office. And so we go back to basics. And that includes covering the different populations of gay identity, whether lesbian women or gay men or bisexuals or transgender individuals of different kinds. We have a lot of the study, particularly this training, the curriculum is my life as an older gay man who came out in the 70s and lived through the 80s and 90s and fought for all this stuff. But we look at the emergence of different LGBTQ identities over time. We look at the cultural context, the HIV epidemic, for example, which was such a huge shadow over the gay community, particularly. We look at different political involvement. We look at defense of marriage. So this cultural continuity as we go along. And then basically, we just try to make it in a personal in a way that people can identify with. It always ends up being a very moving and personal experience. Even for me, the group becomes very close because people overall are being very vulnerable. I think that starts with the instructors being vulnerable, myself and my co-instructor, Christina, and then the group follows. So a lot of people talk about their own experiences or experiences of their relatives or their clients. It's almost a little bit of a group by the end. I'm very proud of what we do. We really establish a firm baseline for this community.
That sounds wonderful. What it sounds like is what's one of the successful components is that you're setting the tone as the instructors so that other people know this is a safe space. This is a place where you can talk about what you want to talk about and share what you want to share.
Absolutely.
I love that.
That's true.
I love that. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. And then Robert, we're going to hear from you about the clinical track within the certification program.
Thank you, David. The good thing is David, I think, does most of the work. So by the time they get to me, module two, or the second part of David's training, it's designed particularly for licensed mental health practitioners who have already completed the previous training. And it looks at a more in-depth clinical aspect of working with LGBTQI plus clients, looking at issues around being inclusive and offering a service to them that actually where people feel heard, understood, and taken into consideration. Some of the things we do look at is understanding sexual fluidity or sexuality are not set and it can move at different times depending on where we are in our lives. It also looks at supporting individuals coming out, which is some of the things that David has just referred to. One of the important aspects also about the training is looking at helping people coming out in unsupportive environments, such as issues around religion or living in household where parents are quite set with religion and you're told it's a sin. There is only one way to live. Look at that. And the other thing we also look at is unwanted sexual attraction. What I probably should say, it's a 3-day training, but I only teach on the first day. There are other colleagues of mine who take that over. And I do find it quite a rewarding training, which I really enjoy the first day because following on from David, I sort of then set the tone for the clinicians. And some of the things we really, really focus on issues around terminology. We look at cultural context. The good thing is also it helps therapists to look at their own professional growth. And we help to challenge biases and so on and so forth. So I think that's probably enough for the moment in terms of where I'm at. And we look forward to talking a bit more.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for that, Robert. ITAP is international, so that means then you have students coming to you from all over the world. This is virtually offered certification training, so you have students coming from all over the world. Are there specific places in the world where you see the bulk of your students, or is it pretty spread out? And is it mostly Western parts of the world, or is it even broader than that?
We have certified about 150 members. And I want to say about 40 of those are clinical. As far as the reach, most of them are in the US. However, we've got a couple Canadians and we've got someone from Slovenia, someone from Amsterdam who's taken our class. They're all included in the first and second module, I believe. And so our reach is international and we are spreading out based on ITAP's community as well, because ITAP is farther than that, farther than everything I've just mentioned.
There are people involved in ITAP from many, many other countries. They just haven't gone through this particular certification training program yet.
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay.
The British contingents I have met, they all live in the US. They are British, but live in the US.
That's interesting. You are still in Britain. Why are they all leaving, Robert? Maybe that's a different conversation, different day.
Given what is happening currently, I think it's a different conversation.
Yes, yes. We'll leave it to that. The three things that pop out for me are the subject of chemsex, sex addiction, unwanted sexual attraction. That definitely caught my ear. What is sex addiction?
When I think about sex addiction currently, because it's not in the diagnostic module, I look at compulsive sexual behavior, which is in the ICD-10. And I think there is slight confusion between people who act out sexually out of choice, between the people where it's problematic and it is pretty catastrophic. So the things that I often look at is when the behavior is persistent and it escalates, when people have tried under numerous attempts that they recognize it's problematic. It could get them into trouble. It could lead to divorce. It could lead to arrest. It could lead to them losing their job, losing their family, and they are doing it regardless as much as they don't want to do it. So they're often failed attempts to reduce or to control the behavior.
You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Xander Kagg, who is meeting with Dr. David Fawcett, Dr. Robert Hudson, and Randall McDaniel. Dr. David Fawcett and Dr. Robert Hudson specialize in sex addiction. Randall McDaniel is the Marketing and Special Projects Manager at the International Institute for Trauma and Addiction Professionals, also known as ITAP. We'll be back shortly.
The station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one supplement brand, help you put back what life takes out. All-in-one comprehensive formulas created to offer you maximum benefit, whatever stage of life you're at. And with a range that supports everything from immunity, energy, cardiovascular health, joints, cognitive function, menopause, and even beauty. We've got you and your family covered. Premium ingredients packed into a powerful daily sachet. Simply mix with water to activate for a flavorful health drink. Perfect at home or on the go. Revive Active. Available at selected Holland & Barrett stores, Well Pharmacies, and online at Amazon and reviveactive.com. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
The station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our first commercial break. We're meeting with the ITAP panel. Let's pick up where we left off.
When people have tried on the numerous attempts that they recognize it's problematic, it could get them into trouble, it could lead to divorce, it could lead to arrest. It could lead to them losing their job, losing their family, and they are doing it regardless as much as they don't want to do it. So they're often failed attempts to reduce or to control the behavior. And as a result of that, they often neglect either personal, social, and professional responsibilities. And when people are often engaging in the behavior, knowing it is wrong and they could get into trouble, they could lose their income, lose their pension, lose their family, or even get arrest, and they continue to do that. Also, the other element of it is where people use sex as a coping mechanism to manage stress, to manage anxiety. They sometimes use it also as a reward. So that's how I approach it, and that's how I help people to look at it, basically.
Why do you think there are people who refuse to acknowledge sex addiction is real? Why do you think that is?
So I think there is an argument labeled as sex addiction therapists that we are very religious. We look at sex within that context, which is actually not true. We don't do that. There is also an argument that there is a lot of shame. That's for me at the moment, I'm having a discussion with sexologists looking at what is healthy versus what is unhealthy. And the clients I work with, I will say to someone, well, if you're single and you want to engage in sexual behavior, which causes no harm to you or anyone, I said, go for it. But if you are in a relationship where you're keeping secrets, you're running the risk of passing STI from yourself to your partner without your partner's consent, that in itself is problematic. So there are numerous debates and a whole range of arguments coming from all fields, the psychoanalytic field, psychotherapist thinks one way, sex therapist thinks another way. There isn't a straightforward answer to that question as to why we disagree. If you think of alcoholism many years ago, that was a similar argument until it was recognized as a problem. And I think because it's not in the DSM, that's where it oftentimes it gets really problematic, basically.
Actually, I have training as a sex therapist and a sex addiction therapist, and then the two slightly different viewpoints. But where some of the questioning of the whole sex addiction concept happens is in the sex therapist side. And I think people are so careful about shutting down someone's sexual expression, sex positivity. We want to be open and sex is healthy and affirming. And of course it is. And I think so sometimes they're reluctant to put any negative or pejorative label on behavior, even though, as Robert clearly laid out, we have very specific diagnostic criteria in terms of loss of control and doing things you don't want and ignoring social responsibilities. All that stuff is there and clear. But I think despite that, people are insisting that when people label that as problematic, they're coming at it from a moralistic point of view, which, as Robert said, is just not true. And I think in many ways, I think it's actually harmful. And I understand they're well-intentioned. But if I have somebody who's an active sex addict who's destroying their lives and their marriage and their relationships, and I'm telling him, let's be sex positive, sex behavior is good, and actually encouraging it, I'm doing harm. And I think that's the problem for that client and me as a clinician. I always tell my clients, sex addiction is not about sex. People are using sex as a coping mechanism. They're using, like somebody else might use alcohol or cannabis, you know, to take the edge off or to step out of their woes for a while, or sexual behavior, but they're not using it in a healthy way. They're using it as a maladaptive coping mechanism.
Correct. And just following on from what you're saying here, David, I often say when I'm in a training, sex addicts have the least amount of sex. Just following on from David's point, it's not about sex at all. It's often about their relationship to it. It's often about the intensity. You can spend 6 months talking to someone and you meet up with them and it lasts for 20 minutes. So it's not actually about sex at all.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. Thank you for that piece. David, let's dive into chemsex.
Well, the term chemsex has caught on, I think, because it's everybody has a concept, at least, of what it must be. It was actually coined by the late David Stewart over in the UK, who was a friend of mine, who worked at a gay men's sexual health clinic and started seeing around 2010 or so, a lot of gay bisexual men who have sex with men, using amphetamines and other drugs, GHB being one, and others in association with sex in this combined ritual. And it was about connection. It was about living room culture, like hanging out, being with like-minded people, being in a place. It was kind of state of mind. And I think he and David's intent with the term chemsex was to really make it specific to men who have sex with men, because he looks at minority stress and internalized homophobia and the impact of the AIDS crisis on a couple generations of gay men and all that cultural component as well, as implying having a role in this addictive behavior. The thing about that is that that behavior, it's important to remember, is not just exclusive to men who have sex with men. I try to honor David's intent of chemsex being specific to that community. But that's where the term sexualized drug use comes in, because we're seeing people all over the world, gay, straight, old, young, male, female, not just amphetamines, different drugs, where they combine. And that gets to the core of what chemsex is, which is really two addictions, or at least two addictions, fused into one. It's me using cannabis when I look at porn. It's me using methamphetamine when I'm having sex. And those things become so entangled in the person's addictive ritual that a true chemsex addict has difficulty doing one without the other. So I've had clients who were arrested, for example, and for pornography. Couldn't you look at porn? They had a whole stash of cocaine and methamphetamine, but it didn't work. Even having all the meth, which is a very powerful drug, didn't work because they use it with porn. And so they really couldn't get high. A lot of guys I treat, and this is my main work with chemsex persons in recovery, when they give up the amphetamines or the other drugs as well, but often amphetamines, meth particularly, because it's just so destructive in their lives, their whole sexual lives fall apart. They can't function sexually at all because their sex lives have become tied literally to that state of intoxication. And so they become sexually anorexic. How do I build healthy sex back into my life in sobriety? So it's really a devastating combination of different addictive, one a process or behavioral addiction, one a drug addiction, and they come together almost magnetically and really tangle everything up.
Okay. So it's not chemsex if you need to take Viagra.
I've had clients say, well, what if I have a glass of wine with my partner before sex? No, that's not chemsex either. It's about when the drug gets involved in the ritual of the addiction. So, and that includes preoccupation. And Robert made a very point about preoccupation, which is often the primary state for a sex addict. It's the planning, it's the anticipating, it's the fantasy, it's the thinking about it before the actual act, if that even occurs. It's a big part of that. So yeah, it's all tangled up. It's not just a glass of wine or a joint or a Viagra.
That's right.
It's much more than that.
Okay. Let's take our second commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Xander Keg, who is meeting with ITAP sex addiction specialists Dr. David Fawcett and Dr. Robert Hudson, in addition to their marketing and special projects manager, Randall McDaniel. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Stop suffering with pet-related allergies when near dogs and cats. Great news, you can feel safe around pets with NasalGuard for pet lovers. NasalGuard topical gel blocks pet dander, hair, and dust mites from entering your nasal passages. Try NasalGuard for pet lovers today. Visit Amazon or nasalguard.co.uk to learn more about NasalGuard spray and gel products. Again, that's nasalguard.co.uk.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our second commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Xander Keg. Xander is meeting with ITAP sex addiction specialists, Dr. David Fawcett, Dr. Robert Hudson, and their marketing and special projects manager, Randall McDaniel, who has been instrumental in growing the Rainbow Advocate Program since its inception in 2021. Let's get back to where we left off.
It makes sense because every time we're planning and thinking and focusing on something that is to come, whether it does or doesn't, is the big dopamine hit. Because once it actually happens, then the dopamine drops and then we're on to serotonin. And so,
which is why, by the way, you see sex addicts often deferring the orgasm because the dopamine flow is in the edging or the preoccupation. So yeah, exactly, yeah. To your point.
We become addicted to our own neurochemicals. Mm-hmm. The military veteran and working previously with the Veterans Department and also the Department of Defense, we would hear a lot about the adrenaline that's pumping through the bodies of service members when they're in combat situations. And then when they come home from that, they don't know what to do with themselves because they feel blank or empty or lethargic, mm-hmm. because they're used to living on that charge of adrenaline. And so for other people, it's going to be dopamine. Just depends on the circumstances. I started going into the bars in the mid 80s in Los Angeles. So I remember Poppers was a big deal. The amyl nitrate. I grew up in California. We called them liquor stores, but they were 7-Eleven. You could go into places like that and buy this little bottle that said locker room deodorizer or VH tape.
Video head cleaner.
Demagnetizer.
Exactly.
And people would be holding it up to their nostrils while they were on the dance floor. I remember I tried it once and I was like, oh boy, that's not good. I was like, no, I got to stay away from it. I was part of the lesbian community. And I don't recall any of my lesbian friends passing around the Poppers bottles. It was our gay male friends and their associates. And why do you think that is? Did I just miss out? I didn't notice it in the 80s in my lesbian circle in Los Angeles. Is there a differentiation between gay men and lesbian women? And just talking in that binary about this chemsex issue.
In my experience, Poppers have been pretty much the realm of gay men or bi men or men who have sex with men, however they identify. And that's been true for years. It's still true. And I think part of it is because what Poppers do is just blow out all those smooth muscles in your body. So it's a head rush that goes with an orgasm. I don't know if it's specifically the male orgasm or not. but also makes anal sex more comfortable. So there's some specific reasons, I think, why gay men use it. And the other thing I'll just say about that is when we talk about recovery, a lot of guys want to hold on to their poppers in recovery because they think it's just a benign drug. And I love what you said, Zander, because it ain't. You know, when you try it, it blows your head off. And so it's a very powerful drug that's very much associated with that high state of intoxication that we need to be careful of. But as far as I know, it's really strictly in the gay community. Or the men.
So interesting, right? I mean, it was equal opportunity. We were in the bars together. Anybody could walk into the corner store and buy it. You didn't have to go to some special place to buy these things. They were pretty readily available. It's interesting. I wonder if anybody's done that research. It might be worthwhile for somebody who wants to dig into that. How about this concept of unwanted sexual attraction? I bet that's a pretty controversial topic.
When we talk about unwanted sexual attraction, what we're talking about here is someone who may be uncomfortable with their same gender sexual attraction and will seek treatment for it. And that's what's been referred to as unwanted sexual attraction. We use this terminology just to help us to make sense of it. There is something about they may want to seek to change their orientation, which is not something I believe you can do. And they may struggle with the pain because they cannot accept who they are. And as a result, they might fear the response from a community that they belong to or their family, or they may simply desire to engage in relationships that are conforming to society, such as being heteronormative, really. So when we think of unwanted same-sex attraction, that's what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. I had some friends in the late 80s, early 90s, two in particular, that went into what was referred to then. It's not as prominent anymore, but into what's called ex-gay ministries, right? Mm-hmm. They went into the Pray the Gay Away programs. And I remember when I was attending my first gay pride parades, starting in mid-1980s, we would see these people lining up a certain part of the street, and they would be shouting religious quotations from scripture, or they would be just making comments. My favorite one was Turner Burn, Jesus Hates Queers. That's my ultimate favorite one that I would hear. The guy would be standing on the top of a van covered in flames with a bullhorn. And I thought, man, he's really into it. This is his whole shtick. It got me very curious. I started thinking about, I'm not learning this in my church. What kind of church is that person going to? And ultimately, that led me almost 20 years later to do a master's in theology. I went to seminary because I wanted to better understand where this comes from. It makes sense to me that there are going to be people who are growing up in a particular household and or in a particular religious system. And that doesn't have to just be Christianity. It could be Orthodox Judaism, could be Islam, could be some forms of Buddhism, right? So they could be growing up in a household that has religious tenets that have a problem with same-sex attraction. And then also just the heteronormativity, the maybe wanting to avoid some of the underside of the life experiences that we probably all have had, and to our varying degrees and experiences of what it's like when you go against what is still considered the norm, because it's the largest percentage of our population that's going to be the standard heterosexual or maybe even bisexual, but in a quote opposite sex marriage with a family. This idea of it's only been in the last maybe 20 years that it was considered generally acceptable within most Western countries that gay men and lesbian women can marry each other. They could have children. They could have a family. They could buy a house. This was back in the day when we had to hide or we'd lose our job. We'd be kicked out of our homes. We'd be run out of our neighborhoods, run out of our churches, these kinds of things. People weren't going to be living openly, and we can live more openly now within at least some of the societies, the ones that we're in currently, right? Britain and the United States. If you're growing up in a society or within a community where that is not the norm, it does make sense to me that some people might want to avoid the scrutiny all the way up to the violence that they could encounter as a result. which is sad, of course. Not everybody thinks, oh, I'm going to just get on a bus or a plane and head out of here.
And Xander, just following on from your point, you know, during the course, one of the things I talk to people about is that sex attraction is not changeable and it cannot be converted. So I think in the past, people have gone to conversion therapy, hoping to convert themselves. You're not able to do that anymore. When we think about sexual orientation, we said here, it is not something that you can change.
I think we've discovered that, thankfully. So we've focused a lot on sexual orientation. I'm wondering, what about gender identity? How does gender identity factor into the courses that you're offering? What are some of the messages that are part of your training program that would specifically focus within this realm of talking about sex addiction, sex therapy, trauma as well, that would be specific to people that would be part of this wider notion of trans community? It's a lot of small communities, but if we just talk about it in that bigger way.
Yes, I think, unless David covers this, I do day one, and I think day two and three cover precisely those issues which you're talking about, which I don't know if Randall can add anything here. Or David, sure. You cover any of this?
The transgender topic, gender identity, the umbrella of gender, is discussed in both trainings. And the first training, which is the Rainbow Advocate and Educator, that one will introduce people to the definition of transgender, definition of gender versus the definition of biological sex. We do talk about intersex population as well. And so there's great coverage in the beginning portion, so everyone has an understanding of who they might be interacting with. The second module, the Rainbow Advocate and Clinical Specialist, will devote a whole entire day to the similar topics that Robert mentioned, but we just take a gender twist. So instead of coming out as gay, lesbian, bisexual, they come out as transgender or non-binary person. And we talk about the unwanted feelings that might exist. And then we also, with the trans and gender section in the clinical, we do cover a lot of the WPATH. We just want to make sure that our clinicians are on the same page as what they're doing with the standard.
Okay. David, you were talking about chemsex. It pertains almost exclusively, if not exclusively, to gay men. Is there something similar when you're working with trans community? Anything that's more prevalent you've seen working with trans individuals or people who have come to your trainings and spoken about?
I think it's important to say that chemsex is a big problem in the trans community as well, not just in the MSM community per se. So in fact, over rates, regardless of chemsex in the trans community, there's higher rates of injection drug use, higher rates of addictive behavior in general. But we also see a lot of methamphetamine use that we would call chemsex. It's spilling over into other boundaries and other populations for sure. That is a problem with the transgender community. My colleagues can speak maybe more thoroughly than I can on this, but I think just the idea of some of the really helping people understand the level of potential violence people have encountered in the community and of risk for violence, at least the stigma. We do a lot of work with minority stress, for example, setting up that concept and how growing up as a minority of any kind has ramifications in terms of how we think about ourselves, in terms of our behaviors and so on. But I think it's especially profound in the transgender community, especially in the last 5 years or so in this country, in the United States. It's ramped up a little bit as communities being exploited for political purposes, but that has real world consequences. So I think just helping people raise the awareness, because I think a lot of times people don't have exposure to that community, and it's really just important to highlight that.
Absolutely.
Did I just add something to what David just said here? I think chemsex is not mainly just about men who have sex with men, particularly the UK at the moment, not just about men who have sex with men. You also have a lot of heterosexuals now who are coming forward who are using chemsex.
That's true. Same in the United States.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you think that it was always that way? It just wasn't getting the same amount of attention? Or do you think this is newer?
If I can speak, I've had the opportunity in the last 5 years or so, I've been working in a sex addiction treatment residential facility in Los Angeles, and mostly heterosexual men. And in that 5 year period, we started seeing a great increase year after year of so-called straight guys who had found methamphetamine, other drugs, GHB, things that were pretty limited to the gay community before. They're starting to find that. And with that level of intoxication and the intensity of those experiences, they start start expanding their sexual arousal, right? So they start having sex with other men. I can't tell you how many women we had wives saying, is my husband gay? Because I just found out he's having sex with men, which he never did before, but it's going with the methamphetamine use. And so it's a dramatically increasing phenomenon, at least in this country right now. That why I wrote that second book, Sex Under the Influence, it really deals with what we call chemsex, but in the larger population.
Mm-hmm. But Robert, I think what you were saying is slightly different, that within heterosexual sexual activities, there's also...
There are heterosexual men, yes, who are having sex with men, but they're also within the heterosexual community.
Yeah.
They are also using chemsex as well.
Right. So interesting. David, why don't you tell us a little bit about your books and what has been the reception to them?
The first book was Lust, Men, and Meth, A Gay Man's Guide to Sex and Recovery. It came out almost 10 years ago and really was my effort to fill in this huge void of lack of total literature about chemsex per se and what to do about it. As a clinician, I was looking for protocols and things that didn't exist. So I found my own way for a while. That book has been amazing because it has resonated with the community consistently now for almost 10 years, with people really finding a way to understand what meth does in the brain, how it works, what the, some of the stigma that goes with it. And it really reduces a bunch of the shame that goes with chemsex behavior. Guys just couldn't understand why they were doing this behavior, which they had a lot of judgment about, because the behavior does escalate in pretty some dark places. And so it really helps demystify it and destigmatize it. So the book has been translated into German. It's translated into Spanish. It's being adopted around the world as this chemsex problem, unfortunately, expands. And then the second book, as I mentioned, is really looking at sexualized drug use among everybody, right? You know, for men, women in heterosexual situations and homosexual situations, just how it's really expanding into this worldwide phenomenon right now.
It is worldwide.
Yeah.
Were you able to have the opportunity to speak with people from all over the world? Is it showing up differently? Is it different drugs in different parts of the world?
Yeah, it is interesting. Some of this availability, but I know, for example, we've watched it spread through Europe and then into Eastern Europe and now Southeast Asia, South America, Africa. But depending on where you're at in different countries, the flavors change a little bit. So you might have methadrone instead of methamphetamine or things like that. But I think there's almost always an amphetamine involved because people are going really for intensity factor here, I think, that goes with it. So depending what people have access to, it does change. But overall, the idea is to just use the drugs as a way to just step into this fantasy bubble and step out of their lives. And I think that's where the importance of what we cover in the RAA program is just so important, with looking at stigma and internalized homophobia and shame and what people do to cope with that. And a lot of the ways they cope with it in a not very healthy way is to step out, just like a sex and porn addict does, by the way. It's the same thing, just stepping into that bubble, just out of my life. I remember a client I had saying, just, well, when I use chemsex, it gives me 8 hours of bulletproof happiness, right? He can step out of his life. None of that matters. And that is very appealing for a lot
of people. Escapism. Robert, do you have any writings? Are you publishing in journals, magazines, blogs? You have writings as well?
Yes. I'll just come to that in just a second. I just wanted to just ask David a question. David, did you find that in bigger cities, such as New York, London, Paris, in those big cities, it was much more problematic rather than other smaller areas?
Yes, it has been. I think the big shift in that area came with apps, right? About the last 10 years or so, with geolocation phones and Grindr and Scruff. And we're finding it now spread into rural areas. People have the means now to connect with each other for both sex and drugs. I think that's changed that dynamic.
And is there a sense that in bigger cities, people have more opportunities, they earn more money, but they're more isolated? And with that isolation comes the opportunities to meet with other people for chemsex?
Right. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
for sure.
Thank you. Xander, going back to your point, I have just submitted a journal article. I'm in the middle of writing a book. I think I'm on chapter 8. I've got 2 more chapters looking at the impact of compulsive behavior and the couple relationship. But I'm actually more interested in writing something fictional. So I'm currently exploring looking at addiction from a fictional aspect, because I think a lot of people have written lots of stuff about it. And I want to come from a slightly different angle to read something which is difficult, but I try and take a slight different twist to it. So I'm sort of still in the early days of that, but it's something that keeps me going rather than just writing a pure academic book, basically, which it's taken me a long time to get here.
Absolutely. No, that sounds fantastic. We have people who are academics and they want to read academic things, and we have lay people that want to read lay things, and fiction is a really good vehicle to communicate ideas. So
that's what I'm thinking of looking at the moment. Yeah.
That's
so
fantastic. I'm
looking at sort of writing lots of short stories and then eventually put the short stories together.
That's wonderful. I like that. I look forward to seeing that. Randall, how about you? Are there projects that you're working on that are specific to the Rainbow Advocate project or program, or just within the community, things that you're doing that you'd like to tell us about so that people can learn about what you're up to?
Sure. I'm currently in grad school, so my books are yet to come. I've got plenty to say.
And you're writing papers.
Yeah, exactly. With the Rainbow program, we are actually attending a lot of conferences. Recently, we've gone to a couple of school counselor conferences and the state and national level. And so we're actually discovering this entirely new world of people that need resources and need assistance with navigating their job. It's because of what's going on politically. Things are back and forth all the time. And so when laws change, when laws are introduced, the teachers and the counselors have to adjust, I think, more than what we realized. They're responsible for a lot. They're, in a sense, the first responders to their students. And so we are starting to take that a little more seriously with our curriculum, and we want to gear it to make sure that school counselors are covered as
Absolutely.
Well.
I remember it's been several years now, but I did attend a conference put on by an organization called CESCL, Community of Excellence or Center for Excellence for School Counselors. And they have a national conference. It was held in San Diego for a couple of years. It might still, because that's where the office is. I was introduced to school counseling. I'm a social worker, but my wife is a marriage and family therapist. And the marriage and family therapy program, the school counseling training program or educational program was in the same department as the marriage and family therapy. And so I learned about school counselors and went to their conference and even presented on a couple of occasions. So I'm happy to hear that you're getting connected in with school counselors, because you're right, they're the first line in the schools. And a lot of people don't realize that a school counselor isn't a psychotherapist. They do very different things from the social workers or the psychologists that are in the schools. So it sounds like a good group of people to outreach to so that they can learn more. They can take what you're teaching into their settings.
Correct. They've got resources also. I found, went to the National School Counselor Association conference, and just to learn what they have at their hands. It'll be a great merge, I think.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Gentlemen, thank you so much for coming on the Umbrella Hour and sharing with us all of this really important information and very interesting information. Let's not leave before we can tell the listener, how can they access ITAP? Tell them where they can go to get more information about ITAP.
Sure. Our website is itap.com, IITAP.com. We have our Rainbow Program website, which is certifiedrainbowadvocate.com. You can find information about the program specific there. It's also on our ITAP website.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much. Well, Dr. Hudson, Dr. Fawcett, Randall, thank you so much for being on the show today and sharing all this great information with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Xander.
We have come to the end of the Umbrella Hour. You've been listening to a panel of professionals. Dr. David Fawcett and Dr. Robert Hudson are faculty members, and Randall McDaniel, who is the Marketing and Special Projects Manager at ITAP, the International Institute for Trauma and Addiction Professionals. We hope that you enjoyed this hour. Thank you for listening.